Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with novelist Margaret Wilkerson Sexton, author of The Revisioners, and Daniel Jose Older, author of The Book of Lost Saints. Wilkerson Sexton is a native New Orleanian who is definitely a writer to watch. Her debut novel, A Kind of Freedom, was longlisted for a National Book Award and the Northern California Book Award. It won the Crook's Corner Book Prize and was the recipient of the first novel award from the Black Caucus of the American Library Association. Her new novel, The Revisioners, is popping up on lists everywhere as a must-read for this fall, and deservedly so. We're speaking to Margaret today from her home in the Bay Area. Margaret, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's so good to be here.
Now, The Revisioners is an exquisite novel. It's filled with the worlds of women within a single family, the social layers within a single city and its neighborhoods, and the way the lives of women intersect across time. So tell us a little bit about this family and these women.
Josephine is one of the main characters, and she is a former enslaved person and a former sharecropper who in 1924 owns her own farm through a stroke of luck. And although she is widowed, she's pretty content. She's surrounded by family and friends. She certainly has more than enough in terms of resources. And I think more than that, she has this distinct memory of slavery and of escaping from slavery. And so relatively, her life feels fulfilled. And then a woman moves in next door, a younger white woman who's not as confident. And she tries to strike up a friendship with Josephine. And Josephine is cautious at first, and then she acquiesces, and they do form a connection. And ultimately, Josephine learns that her neighbor is a member of the KKK, and that ends up affecting the family in unimaginable and deleterious ways. And then many generations later, we have Josephine's great-great-great-granddaughter, who is a biracial woman who moves in with her white grandmother. And it seems like it'll be a win-win. The grandmother is in ill health, and Ava is financially strapped. It goes well at first, and then some of the same dynamics that show up between Josephine and the neighbor start to show up in this house many generations later between Ava and her grandmother, and the storylines start to threaten to converge. With the characters, I wanted to show stability, empowerment, strength. And so despite all the suffering that I've alluded to in these pages, I also think it's mostly a novel about redemption and about hope and about passing along wisdom and power through the bloodline. So you're passing along, of course, the trauma, but with that trauma, there comes the strength that was gained through triumphing over it.
I wonder if you'd read a passage for us from Josephine's point of view. It takes place in 1855.
That sounds great. Josephine, 1855. The Revisioners met every Sunday after market, our feet cracked and peeling from bartering poultry, horseshoes, or wood bowls along the levee. At some plantations, Mama would only nod at the slaves, and at some, she would hum a song. She didn't speak the words, but I knew them. It's true they cannot catch me. There is a schooner out at sea. It's true they cannot catch me. The people she sang for would appear in the swamp that night, 300 yards past the point where the last cabin crossed with the sugar house. 18 of us gathered in the dark. We sat around an altar covered in blue cloth, milk and sugar, corn, jars of water, a pot of sage, melon seeds, and scraps of pork we snuck from supper. My mama would walk a circle counterclockwise around us, directing our prayers and lamentations. they sold my baby over the river, or my husband took sick and it won't be much longer, or my child is in trouble and I got to throw up my hands, until our grief was ripe for healing and our hearts were clear to praise. The praise started with gratitude, gentle rumbling skirting over each other, the sun on our faces, healthy babies with gums shining, hope for the by and by, and then the tempo would rise, shouts would leap, and you couldn't catch one blessing. It was so mingled with the one before it. Full belly some of the time, and someone's mother died, but she didn't suffer. And a man who sang, and a woman who said yes, and white folks being as good as they can be, and even if they showed themselves who they really were, hope for the by and by. And Mama would stand up and start swinging her arms and switching her hips and slamming her feet down, and everyone surrounding her would follow suit. That was when the soil was fertile. That was when our minds could grow crops. Mama would remind us of all the stories we had heard about the women before us, many of whom made it rain without a cloud in the sky. Some of our father's men only had to point a finger for corn to grow. That's not what we were after. But then again, it was too. My mama carved 18 stones, and only one of them had a star on it. And come summer, whoever picked that star would flee. It was our job to see they made it over. Even now, I can recall the little girl I was, pressing my mind into itself as hard as I could. The crisper the picture, the more likely the vision was to take place, Mama said. So I scrunched up my eyes and felt myself cushioned between my mother and father. I didn't know what north looked like, only that we were 20 miles west of New Orleans, but I imagined there was sunshine, a big fiery ball of it set low in the sky, and even as it was twisting up higher, I could almost touch it because I was running.
Oh, that's so beautiful. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Margaret Wilkerson Sexton, author of The Revisioners. One of the interesting things is that so many of these characters are revisioners in the larger sense of the word. They're healers and they're hopers.
Right, they are. So revisioner is a name that I made up. It's not a word that I've heard before. But it's the idea that you can recreate your life, and you can even recreate your descendants' life through the way you handle whatever trials are sent to you in this lifetime. So the idea of healing and hope is not only pertinent to one generation, but it's woven through many, and it's always a possibility.
And all these women are concerned with raising children in a world that is as dangerous now as it was in 1855. They have the same concerns about their children.
That was interesting. Yeah, I mean, I struggled with that a little bit because, of course, in 1924 and in 1855, the dangers are extremely physical, and they're obviously physical. There's no question about it. But in the present day, although that is, of course, the reality still, unfortunately, the danger of physical harm or death, I wanted to do something a little bit different in that section, not because the physicality isn't a reality, but because there's also something I think really insidious about the psychological damage done to families who have to worry about the fear of something happening to their Black children. And so I just thought it would be an interesting way to change the narrative a little bit. There's still the danger, but it's a little bit more subtle. It's certainly psychological, and it's arguably as damaging.
Now, Ava, for example, is seeking a better school for her son. And so she moves in with her white grandmother, Martha, in uptown New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And Martha is deteriorating. She's getting older. She's not thinking. Her mind is not necessarily her own. But she explodes every now and then in racist language and also subtle comments like telling Ava's son at the dinner table that he'll have better friends.
Right.
And he is so smart. He said, you know, my friends were just fine. You know?
Right. I know. It's an interesting thing where the child picks up on it before the mother does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that subtlety is like, that's exquisite because that shows the presence of this kind of language in so many conversations, however well-intended.
Right. And it's this woman's grandmother. So it's like, obviously there's that love there, their family, but you can't escape it because it's woven into our country's fabric. You know, it's not that some people have it and some people don't have it. There are some people who are self-conscious and self-aware about challenging themselves when it comes up, but we're all susceptible to that kind of racist programming. And that's what you see in that family. It's been there lurking, and when her guard is down because she's deteriorating mentally, it comes up.
And Gladys, who's one of the most appealing characters to me, is Ava's mother. And she's been a lawyer, but she has become a doula, a midwife, and she's busy bringing a new generation into the world.
Right. And she's an interesting character. I mean, I actually know people like her.
I hope I do.
I mean, I just love how she's made this change in the middle of her life to not eat meat and just tried all these different religions. And I think some of her character is definitely comedic to me in her openness and her new age philosophy that she's recently adopted. I think she's comedic, and she's also a voice of wisdom in the book. And it's hard earned wisdom because she knows Martha. She was her daughter-in-law. So she knows that generation, and she's older. She knows the generations in general. And she's in a situation where she's trying to convey that to her daughter, but her daughter is more optimistic.
Well, it seems to me that in all your work, you have this impulse toward community. When you talk about, in this book, the ones who got us over, the ones who got us through, you're always talking about honoring those who came before and long histories. So that's really something that's important to you as a theme.
Right. And that's another thing I don't think about doing. It's not conscious. I guess it's just how I grew up. It's like the first exposure I had to life was through that framework. My mom was a single mom, and my dad was involved, but, you know, they didn't live together. So They both worked, and I was really, my grandmother raised me, my aunt raised me. It was an entire village that raised me. So I was always around other families and communities, and it was so different back then. You know, you just would walk. We lived in the East, and we would just walk 5 minutes to my aunt's house, and, you know, I would just be over there. No one needed to call. You would just show up. My mom had 6 siblings, and they all lived within about a mile of each other. That's how I grew up until I moved to Connecticut. It was a very fluid family in that way. Mm-hmm. And so I guess it's just part of my makeup. And so that's how I approach stories, because it's what I know.
That's a rare and wonderful thing, to grow up with so many family members in the same block or neighborhood.
I know. And I created the totally opposite life. It's me and my husband. His brother lives an hour and a half away. Well, I have extended family that lives about an hour away. I do have extended family that lives an hour away, but I didn't grow up with them or anything, but they are great. And I do see them often, but, you know, that small circle of my mom's siblings and their kids that I grew up with, we're all scattered now.
Well, I know you still have people who love you in New Orleans.
And
lots of people who love your books.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
We've been talking with Margaret Wilkerson Sexton, whose wonderful new book is The Revisioners. You can meet her Tuesday, November 5th from 6 to 9 at the Hotel Peter and Paul at 2317 Burgundy. Margaret, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. I'm so good to be here.
I got my patience and I'm making do. I learned my lessons from the ancient roots. I choose to follow what the greatest do. A bird with a word came to me. The sweetness of a honeycomb tree. And now I look what's taking over me. Couldn't fake it if I wanted to. I had to wake up just to make it through.
Daniel Jose Older is one of my favorite writers. His books, the Shadow Shaper Cipher series, the Bone Street Rumba series, and the most recent Dactyl Hill Squad series for young readers, fairly burst with action and energy and memorable characters. And now we have his best, most beautiful novel so far, The Book of Lost Saints, a literary novel that draws on his own family stories and is set during the Cuban Revolution. Daniel Jose Older, welcome back.
Thank you. It is so great to be here. I love coming on this show.
This is such a gorgeous book, gorgeous in every way. And at the heart of it is this restless spirit, Marisol, who's trying to find her way to a kind of resolution of her life. So talk a little bit about how she does that.
So Marisol appears essentially almost out of the ether, right? In 2004, New Jersey, after disappearing during revolution-era Cuba. And she doesn't know what happened. She just knows now she's a spirit. And she barely remembers her own life. And her only mechanism for finding out what happened and even finding out what she's lived through is through Ramon, who is her nephew and he's just kind of this lump of a dude who's a DJ and a hospital security guard. And she realizes that it's only by essentially infiltrating his dreams. And there inside of his dreams, she can find her memories and start to piece them back together, piece her life back together. So she goes about doing that. That's the frame of the whole story.
I think he's a little more than a lunk of a dude.
He's a great lump. He's a wonderful, wonderful person. When we meet him, and she says this at the beginning, you know, he's very, very talented. And like people who are very talented at something, he kind of lets everything else slide.
Right. No, there, I'll give you that.
He's a great musician and he has a great heart, you know, and he's a wonderful person and he's a little bit of a lump.
All right. Well, I want you to read a little piece that shows how Marisol inhabits him and what he is like a bit.
Ramon wakes, the dream still with him. The world still strange and hazy with the heat of our Havana suburb, the shock of a much colder, grayer city outside the window. And I hover just above him, feeling empty and even more barely there than before. It drains me, this cruel gift of my memories that I give. It takes something small and immeasurable from me. I know I'll replenish, can already feel the damage begin to undo itself as I strengthen. But if memories are all that make me, there can't be an endless supply. Even re-energized, something is gone. There's only so much of my life I can give. And everything feels different now that I'm on a first-name basis with that seeping, vanishing sensation, my undoing. The notebook lies open on the bedside table beside him. In it, the tiny event of my trip to the butcher, my return home, is scrawled out in his sloppy handwriting. Ramon eyes the pen, considering adding this strange new chapter, but it's time to leave, almost past time, and he has to make it to the club to set up. He hurls himself into a sitting position and stumbles to his feet, and for a second, I think he's going to dash off out the door and be on his way. He is about to be late, after all. But this is Ramon, of course, and so instead he Ramons his way through that unintelligible sequence of yawns, grunts, eye rubs, and crackling joints. Then he stands perfectly still for a few moments. And at first I think he's fallen back asleep. I venture closer, allow myself to merge with him. Music. It ripples through him like light on a lake, just the rough sketches of melodies that rise and fall and cut suddenly short, chortling waves of notes that crash into each other and then cycle back towards some vaguely defined one. Sudden blasts of harmonies that diminish and then are gone, but mostly there are rhythms, the fanciful and abrupt lullaby of the huamanco, that loving familiar side dash of the bolero, the high clack of the clave, which waits and then lands on each beat, then waits again and slips between them. And now Ramon opens his eyes. He is ready.
Well, you can just read to me all day now. But that is a lovely example of how intertwined they become. Mm-hmm. And she gives him these terrible gifts of her memories, and he must write them down and deal with them. Now, you said that this is partly drawn from your own family story. So what was the process of uncovering those stories and turning them into fiction?
Yeah, I would say it's inspired by, not based on, as a very right. important point to clarify, because it is so complicated, right? Like these, I think terrible gifts is what you said, right? Like
yes.
It is, you know, memories are in some ways very terrible gifts. They're equal parts terrible and gifts. And that's
right.
exactly the challenge, and that's true, you know, especially for those of us in different diasporas and in exiles and all these legacies we carry. So a lot of these stories that it's inspired by are really stories that I grew up hearing, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know, just different members of my family had been involved on different levels of the revolution in different parts, and the family itself was divided by it in different ways, like most Cuban families.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just a part of the sort of family lore. And I know at a certain age, you know, I asked my mom to dig deeper for me, and not even in terms of research. I actually just, you know, had the more complex conversations with her than just this is what happened, but, you know, the why and the and the historical context behind it. And I talked to my different uncles and aunts, and at different times also traveled back to Cuba and talked to some of the ones that stayed. And so it's through research, you know, through talking, through conversations, through talking with folks totally outside of my family who had their own experiences of the revolution. And then through, of course, my own just historical research and different books and everything else. It all really came together over the course of my whole life without really necessarily being angled towards a book.
Right.
Until I took this fateful walk with my friend Sam Reynolds, who's an astrologer and one of my best friends. And I was about to go off to an MFA program. And I said something like, I'm not sure what I'm going to write next. He said, what about the Isle of Pines, you know, which is a famous island in Cuba where there was a prison where some of my family members were actually kept. And it had always been on my mind, in the back of my mind. And when he said that, he said, what about the ghosts that would live there?
Ah.
And I said, oh, man. Yes.
Yes.
And that was it. You know, it's, I always think of stories like avalanches, right? And sometimes you just need to move one stick and the whole mountain just tumbles down. And that's really what happened. It came very quickly.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Daniel Jose Older, author of the Book of Lost Saints. And there's this incredible sexual energy in this book between Eliciana and Ramon, for starters. That must have been fun to write.
It was. It was a lot of fun.
But you even give the saints, Los Santos, real sexual aspects when we're looking at a book of the saints.
Right.
Can you describe that?
No, but but I can tell you that I think it's fascinating, these intersections of the sacred and the sexual.
Yes.
And I think, you know, to different degrees we acknowledge it, and to other degrees we're supposed to just pretend it's not happening, but we can all see it happening, right? There's an immense corporal element to Catholicism, and it is sometimes very sexualized, and sometimes we pretend it's not, but it's there, it's all there. And I think it's sort of fascinating to explore that and to think about how that is for all of us who are a part of it and witnessing it and interacting with it in different ways. But then also, I think when we think about the Orishas, they're very amazing in their humanity as much as their divinity.
Yes.
And in their, I don't want to say flawed, it's more that, you know, they have personalities, and that's why we connect to them. They're not these like faraway godheads or perfect saints that have never made mistakes. They're complex, and they have relationships with each other that go wrong, you know, and they have relations with each other and all of these different levels to it. And that's something I value about them, and also something I think deserves to be in books.
And they suffer pain, and they have pain, desire.
Right. Exactly. And I think I talked last time about how the Iliad was one of my favorite books as a child. And that's one of the things that's so great about all of those Greek myths. But especially in the Iliad, we really feel that sort of complexity of divinity being also very human, messy. That's what we love about it.
Yes. When you were writing this book, did you feel that you were writing something different even for you? I mean, you've carved out so much territory just on your own, and it's so distinctive, your voice. But this is transcendental. I mean,
Thank you.
Such a pleasure.
Thank you. It did feel that way. And I couldn't exactly describe why. I just knew it was a book that I wanted to take a lot more time with, not in the sense of the time it took to write it, more so in the sense of not trying to push the plot as hard forward as I tend to do when I'm writing more genre work, and just really allowing the smaller moments to take their time on the page and exist and still lead towards these larger moments and still play their part in the arc of the story, which is to say, I didn't want to go off on whole tangents that had nothing to do with anything.
Yeah.
But I wanted to allow the smaller moments of life that I might have skipped over in a more genre novel to really shine and just to be patient.
You can't have a revolution without tenderness every now and then.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
We've been talking with Daniel Jose Older, whose gorgeous new novel is The Book of Lost Saints. You can meet him Wednesday, November 6th at 6 p.m. when he discusses his book with Jamie Hadley at Garden District Bookshop. Daniel, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
Wow.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week here in New Orleans. Blue Cypress Books will hold a day of signings during the Oak Street Pullboy Fest Sunday, November 3rd. Here's the schedule. From noon to 2 p.m., Marty Dumas signs The Little Human. Sally Asher and Melissa Van Diver sign The Mermaid's Night Before Christmas. From 2:15 to 4, Emma Fix signs Snippets of New Orleans. And from 3 to 5, Brian Camp signs Gather the Fortunes. Paula Mounier discusses and signs Blind Search, a Mercy Carr mystery, Sunday, November 3rd at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. Jamie Attenberg and Margaret Wilkerson Sexton appear in conversation with Ann Gisselson to discuss their books, All This Could Be Yours and The Revisioners, Tuesday, November 5th from 6 to 9 at the Hotel Peter and Paul, 2317 Burgundy. This is also part of the Women's National Book Association, NOLA, celebration of National Reading Group Month. The Lakeshore Branch Library at 1000 West Esplanade in Metairie hosts National Novel Writing Month events four different evenings during the month of November. Tuesdays, November 5th, 12th, 19th, and Monday, November 25th from 5 to 8:30. National Novel Writing Month is an annual event that encourages writers to work toward the goal of writing a 50,000-word novel by 11:59 p.m. on November 30th. Shannon Kitchens, a Jefferson Parish Library staff person and the municipal liaison for New Orleans, will be present to explain how NaNoWriMo process works. Daniel Jose Older appears in conversation with writer-filmmaker Jamie Hatley, discussing The Book of Lost Saints, Wednesday, November 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The University of New Orleans Creative Writing Workshop hosts a reading by poets Brad Richard and Jerrica Marchand, Wednesday, November 6th at 8 at the UNO Lakeside Campus, Liberal Arts Building, Room 197. The reading will be followed by a Q&A, book signing, and brief reception. Deb Janerson discusses and signs her novel, The Women of Dauphine Street, Thursday, November 7th at 6 at the Alvar Library. The Friends of the UNO Library hold a used book sale Thursday, November 7th from 10 to 6, Friday, November 8th from 10 to 4, and Saturday, November 9th from 10 to 2. There's an admission fee for the first 2 hours on Thursday only, always free for students and members. There's still time to buy tickets to the Friends of the New Orleans Public Library's James Bond-themed scavenger hunt throughout the main library. That's Saturday, November 9th from 6:30 to 10:30 p.m. Proceeds from this event support the library's 2020 Summer Fun program. FriendsNOLA.org for tickets. Next weekend, it's time for Improv NOLA, a Festival of Ideas, November 8th through 10th. Jules Pfeiffer and Michael Pollan are the headliners, and there are many other writers to meet as well. Check out ImprovConferenceNOLA.com for tickets and the complete schedule. Also coming up later this month is Words and Music, a Literary Feast in New Orleans, November 21st through 24th at the Ace Hotel and other locations around town. The theme this year is Mapping Change. More details at wordsandmusic.org. Don't forget to listen in next Tuesday at 7:44 a.m. during Morning Edition and 5:44 p.m. during All Things Considered for our new series, Thinking Outside the Book. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org.